Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In 1990, the National Gallery of Art launched an initiative to acquire the finest examples of the art of photography and to mount photography exhibitions of the highest quality, accompanied by scholarly publications and programs. In the years since, the gallery's collection of photographs has grown to nearly 15,000 works encompassing the history of the medium from its beginnings in 1839 to the present, featuring in-depth holdings of work by many of the masters of the art form. Commemorating the 25th anniversary of this initiative, the gallery presents the exhibition The Memory of Time, Contemporary Photographs at the National Gallery of Art, acquired with the Alfred H. Moses and Fern M. Schad Fund. On view from May 3rd through September 13th, 2015, The Memory of Time explores the work of 26 contemporary artists who investigate the complex and resonant relationship of photography to time, memory, and history. In this conversation, recorded on May 17th, 2015, artist Vera Luter and exhibition curator Sarah Greeno discussed Luter's work featured in the exhibition and permanent collection within the context of her career.
I want to welcome you here this afternoon to the first of what will be several interviews with artists who are represented in our exhibition, The Memory of Time, Contemporary Photographs at the National Gallery of Art, acquired with the Alfred H. Moses and Fern M. Schad Fund. This afternoon, we're delighted to have Vera Luter with us. She is one of the most distinguished artists represented in this exhibition. Those of you who've seen the show will have seen her extraordinary photograph, which is in the second room. Vera, I have to say, has had an exceptionally difficult time getting here today between Amtrak and canceled flights on U.S. Air. So she literally arrived just minutes before this presentation this afternoon, so we're really pleased to have her here. Vera Luter was born in Germany, and she studied at the Academy of Fine Arts in Munich, where she received her degree in 1991. She came to the United States and got an MFA from the School of Visual Arts in New York in 1995, by which point she had already established her distinctive style and begun to exhibit her work. Pioneering a radically new vision of the world, Ms. Luter began to make camera obscura photographs in the early 1990s that were unlike anything being done at the time. And they really challenge our understandings of the possibilities of photographic expression. In recognition of her significant accomplishments, she's been the recipient of numerous awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2001 and a Pollock Krasner Foundation grant in 2002. And her work has been exhibited widely at the Reina Sofia, the Pompidou, Dia Beacon and Dia Chelsea, MoMA and the Whitney. And it's also been collected very widely at museums such as MoMA, the Whitney, SF MoMA, the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, and we're very pleased to say now here at the National Gallery as well. The esteemed critic, writer, and professor Jonathan Creary speaks of Luter's remarkable singularity, and he notes how she creates work that are not just about scale and the new relationship of photography to truth in the digital age, but something more. As he writes, she explores lines of thought and creative pathways that have no parallels anywhere. I hope we can address some of those lines of thoughts and parallels and pathways today, this afternoon, in our conversation. So welcome, Vera, and thank you for coming. Shall we begin with how you started off as an artist, what perhaps inspired you? Thank you. Did you know from your very earliest years that you wanted to be an artist?
I think so. I think so. I remember, and I must have been 6 or 5, that my father asked me what I wanted to be one day, and I said, my own boss. Which I feel like is pretty close to being an artist. Yes, and then by the age of 15 or so, I had gone all the way to being quite rebellious and wanting to leave school and move to Amsterdam and study art. And my parents said no. And so the compromise was found. I became a ceramicist and did an apprenticeship in a wonderful ceramic studio, which was really an truly artistic environment, as the only apprentice with an elderly couple. And then after having also received a master's degree in ceramics, Germany still has those, I forget, degrees within the crafts too. That was a 6 or 7 year journey. So with the master degree, I said enough of this and went to the Academy of Fine Arts, where I started to work with sculpture, and you're seeing an example here.
And here's another early piece by Vera. Were these part of a project to receive your degree? These few pieces that we're seeing here.
Yes, they were exhibited in my. It's called a diploma. It means nothing. You can't get anything for it. But it's the degree with which you finish art school in Germany. You can actually apply for grants once you've finished school, which is important.
And so it was, you came to this country then in 1991 to study at the School of Visual Arts in New York.
That's right. It was actually 1993, mm-hmm. So a little later. And basically by the suggestion of friends that I studied with in Munich, they said, oh, New York's really interesting. New York is really great. New York is really where contemporary art is happening. A friend of mine who had finished before me had received this particular grant to spend 9 months, an academic year, in New York, and had just come back. And I felt like, okay, why not? You know, why not try New York? That was really all there was to it. Also an intuition, but no more than that. And I applied for this fairly competitive government grant, and luckily was awarded it and came for 9 months, and that is 22 years ago.
And did you come expecting that you would continue to study, to work with sculpture, or were you feeling that sculpture was coming to an end for you at that moment?
I definitely felt that I was at crossroads and that I needed to I felt stuck a little bit. And as you can see with what we have shown in slides there, I was still leaning towards the potter's wheel. What you're seeing here is made of porcelain. I was working myself away from the crafts that I had studied, which I loved, but my thinking and my creative impulses were still somewhat tied into what I had learned. And I did definitely feel that I was looking for a new inspiration, but I didn't know what that would be. And I should say, with this grant comes the obligation to be enrolled into graduate school. So I had already a graduate degree, but wanting to be abroad, that was the request that this grant came with. And so I thought, okay, I enroll at School of Visual Arts in the photography department simply to learn something practical that I could apply to my art making, so that I could document my own work, print a portfolio. I did not really want to go yet to another school. I felt I had been filled up with philosophies on what is right and wrong in contemporary art sufficiently. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's how I landed in the photography department.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so then, how did you make the leap from thinking about photography really as something that was going to record and document your art to making, for example, this kind of work?
Yeah, that's nice. So I arrived in New York and I had a loft in Midtown in the Garment District that I inherited from this friend that had been there before. And I shared this loft with another student, and later I found out it was an illegal sublet, but what did I know? You know, I was there for 9 months and rent seemed high and nobody else lived in the building, but it was New York, right? It's like things were different. So, but we had these amazing views. It being in the Garment District in Midtown on the West Side, which had been built up in the 20s and 30s with old commercial high-rises. And we were on the top floor, and it was just magnificent. We had so much light and beautiful views out over the city, and yet also into the windows of the surrounding buildings, which were all factories of the garment industry. And so I spent a lot of time sitting there and watching the city and absorbing all the things that were new to me. And that's where the idea came from, to basically create a record of my impressions in this, for me, new place. And the idea was to use the space in which I lived and experienced these things as a recording device, as a camera, and to use the windows of the space through which the information came in and to me as the seeing eye, and then to replace just my own subjectivity with a sensitive material, which was photographic paper. That's how it all came about, and that's the first photograph that I made. It's about, what is it? Yeah, well, it's 65 inches by 82 inches wide, two sheets of photographic paper. You can see I seamed it in the center to achieve the size I wanted to achieve. And I simply put it on the wall opposite the window. I darkened the entire loft. I put a little pinhole on the window surface, lined the wall opposite the window with photographic paper, and the pipe you're seeing on top of the image is a radiator pipe, which of course ran low, but the view that projects itself into the room in a camera is upside down and reversed. So turning it up upside down again gives us this piece with radiator pipes in the sky.
I think we have, I brought here, for those of you who aren't familiar, an illustration of a camera obscura, which is literally what Vera did. Camera obscura means darkened room. So as Vera has said, she darkened her windows, which would have been here, created a camera out of her room. There's an optical phenomenon by which light passing through a very small opening projects an image of the outside world on the opposite wall. And this is the foundation, of course, of all cameras. Camera obscuras have, the phenomenon has been known for quite a while. Camera obscuras have been used from the late Renaissance. More portable versions such as this, which has been equipped with a lens and then a mirror here to reflect the image up onto a piece of ground glass here where someone has put a piece of tracing paper on top and is tracing the image outside. More portable camera obscuras like that had also been around for many centuries before the invention of photography. But even still, it's a rather radical way of thinking about depicting New York. I think that most people would probably have thought about taking pictures out of the window as opposed to turning the room itself into a camera obscura.
Yeah, And my roommate took pictures out of the window. Many of them. I took some too. Haven't looked at them in a long time. But having grown up in Germany in the 80s and having gone to art school in the 80s, conceptual art was what dominated the discussion at the time. And so intuition and instinct were all things that were highly, how can I best say this, disregarded at the time. Whereas a conceptual approach was sort of the demand. I felt I had to have a reason for what I was doing, had to have a good explanation. The concept was the birth of the art. And here I was, and I was going to make this one time and then move on to hopefully another good idea. Mm. And when I had a good friend in art school, he helped me some get this going. He had more photographic knowledge than I did, which he actually did have photographic knowledge. I had none. And so when he and a few other people first saw my early images, they were really excited and said, you have to keep doing this. You can't just stop now. And I felt like, oh, no, next concept has to be thought of. Anyway, I kept going.
The technical challenges must have been huge. I mean, if this one really was among your first, and it's so big, the exposure time, processing it, all of that must have required a significant amount of experimentation before one arrived at such great final results. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was incredibly hard. It took me 6 weeks to make this one picture just because I didn't realize that my exposure time would be 5 hours. And yes, developing a large piece of photographic paper, nobody knew how to do it, and least did I. And when I arrived in school with these big rolls of photographic paper and said, where's the developer and how does this work? They said, how about you try an 8x10? And I said, no. And so over time I learned.
But you also made the very important decision early on, and that is to use the images that you captured on your wall, to use those negative images as the final work of art. You never thought about making prints from these negatives so that we would have the positive view of New York? Did that idea ever occur to you, and did you dismiss it very, very quickly, very soon, as you were starting to work?
It never occurred to me, never. Because I didn't come from a photographic background, which is really an enormous blessing, because I think there's a reason why very few other people have tackled with pinhole cameras the size I do. There are other people doing similar things, but if you really are educated as a photographer, you know what you're getting yourself into, and you don't want to do it. I didn't know what I was getting myself into, and the excitement over the little steps that I took carried me forward. Mm-hmm. And I didn't judge my work based on the technical aspects of what I did. You can say of this piece, underexposed on the bottom, wrinkles. I'm not sure what else you could criticize it for, but those weren't my concerns. And I wanted to maintain the immediacy of the experience. That was really, really my key interest, that the immediate experience that I had in that situation would simply be captured by the space. And the scale of the image, of course, references the ambiance in which I was, the room in which I lived. And So when the image is exhibited, as you can see in our show, and you stand, a viewer stands in front of it, one really has that relationship to the space. I mean, it's of course altered, otherwise it would be sort of dull, I suppose, but it is an, you can feel as though you were walking into an architectural space, experiencing an environment. And that's the reason for the scale also in which I work.
And did you ever consider inverting the images? Because of course the camera obscura or pinhole projects an upside down view of the world onto the back wall. Did you ever think about yourself inverting them?
So to speak, hanging them right side up?
Yeah.
Hanging
them the way they were originally exposed.
I did. For a long time, I spent weeks looking at them this way and that way. I then moved somewhere to the Upper West Side, to a small apartment, and I had a wall big enough to hang them, and I thought a lot about them. But I felt that I clearly wanted to stay outside, away from the possibility of it being a didactic endeavor, so to speak. Can we go back to your beautiful? Yeah. I mean, this is gorgeous, but if one did something like this in a contemporary environment, it would be like, and here's the pinhole, and this is the view, and it comes in upside down, and it is reversed, and that's how the camera works. And I really wanted to sort of give it its own life and create enough of a recognizable environment for the viewer so that the viewer can connect to the image and yet sort of estrange it in many ways so that the mind is being captured and the mind of the viewer is sort of kicking in and going its own way.
Estrange is a very good word, I think, to use with your photographs, because they are, I think, profoundly disconcerting images. It's a world we know, but we don't know it. Everything is reversed. What is black in the world is now white. What is white is now black. Forms that should have substantial mass seem to be completely empty. They seem to be voids. This sense of a very disconcerting and uncanny space comes up in your work, I think, almost from its inception, which is also fascinating. And yet, at the same time, you seem very early on to take often this quite methodical approach to recording the views. I mean, this one is the north view. This one, the east view. I think the next one is the west view. Were these all made from the same location, or?
Yeah, this was my second opportunity to work in New York, and I had met someone who was very excited about my sculptural work. Someone in Germany had told him about my sculptural work, with which I was, you know, modestly successful. At least it got me the grant to go to New York. So he approached me in New York and said, I would like to see your work. And I said, sorry, no more sculpture, photographs now. And he didn't care for the photographs, but he sort of, I guess, felt like it was worth helping me out with location. And so I was able to use this office space in which his man worked and had sort of some leading position, and make photographs. And I developed this concept of making images of all four views on the compass, then wanting to exhibit them on their respective axes, the north, east, west, and south, which also resulted into my graduation show, which you see here.
unfortunately not hung on the north, south, east.
No, the space didn't provide for that, unfortunately, no.
When did you recognize the important role that time was playing in these, in your photographs? Not only the length of time of the exposure, but what that long exposure was doing to our normal understanding of time in photography.
Not quite sure when sort of I started recognizing that. I had read, because we were all reading in art school, and so I had read Roland Barthes, mm-hmm. Camera Lucida, mm-hmm. and I had read other theoretical books about photography in Germany, and I had knowledge of Andy Warhol's film Empire State mm-hmm. Building. And I certainly thought of it, as you saw in my first picture, the Empire State Building was just standing there. And my roommate and I loved looking at it. It was really wonderful. It was much more beautifully lit at the time, more modestly and more simply lit. And it switched off every day at midnight. And that was just, it was just something sort of, it was sort of part of my life. And and this film that I, or this, yeah, a film that Andy Warhol made, I forget when, but in the 60s, I suppose, mm-hmm. he just filmed the Empire State Building for close to 24 hours, mm-hmm. I think. And that reference was there for me, and I always thought of, it's just simply the way it is. In film, you run frame after frame after frame. Warhol didn't move the camera, recorded one particular subject, but on many, many image frames. Whereas I open my camera and record over many hours just onto one, if you wish, frame or one negative format. So I thought about things in this regard. But I think the whole notion of the importance of time, it developed slowly in my work. And I had to somehow redefine it because, as you also say in the beautiful essay that Sarah wrote accompanying the catalog, Roland Barthes creates this theory between the moment of time when the image was taken, the photograph was taken, and the time when we look at it. And we're looking at this time span in between, but there's this one, you know, relatively short moment of exposing the negative, short at least compared to what I do. My longest exposure is 3 months. My shortest is several hours. So I had to sort of redevelop a relationship to that because it didn't, I felt like what I did didn't fit within photographic theory.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly didn't fit with the way most 20th century photographers had been capturing the world, the Cartier-Bresson decisive moment, that fraction of time that revealed the world in perfect balance. You are, in one picture, sort of collapsing many, many moments of time down into one image. In many ways, it does hark back to some of the earliest photographs that were made, and there do seem to be many parallels with your work with some very, very early 19th century photography. Not only are you using a very primitive camera, as many early photographers did, but their exposures as well, like Gustave Legray's, were often fairly long, several seconds, sometimes even longer than that. And yet they too were fascinated with capturing these sort of little incidents of modern life. For example, the person there looking at the stalls that have been lined up on the edge of the wall, something that your much longer process does not allow for at all, as we can see in these great views, but the same sort of high, almost panorama-like vision, elevated view, looking down at the river in front here. You said once that your work is informed by an interest in parallels between the industrial development beginning in the 19th century and the discovery of the chemical process to make a stable photographic image. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that, particularly in relationship to photographs like the flats and others in your early work?
Yes, that is. I've been fascinated with, as I came to photography or to analog photography basically when it was just knocked out. So if you think I came to America in 1993, and studied between 93 and 95. By 95, I mean, I forget, but every year there was less, you know, the analog photographic world was getting smaller and the digital medium was taking over, and pretty much anybody who engaged with analog photography was considered a retro backwards person. Yes, so, but The obviously, as we all know, yeah, photographic chemistry was found and invented. 1839 is sort of the date given, and further developed throughout the 19th century, running parallel with the industrialization of the world, and yet it also sort of its demise runs parallel to at least the industrialization of the Western world. And many of the things that I photograph with my technique are sort of the ruins of the grandeur of the most ambitious human endeavors within this industrial world at the time that are then left to decay. That's one aspect. Another one that is less related to photography and probably much more personal is I grew up in the Ruhr Valley, in the industrial center of Western Germany, which was completely destroyed in both world wars and rebuilt after both world wars, and I grew up with like images of the most breathtaking, astounding, and overwhelming industrial monuments and fabrics and what have you around me where I grew up. And I think that also informed me. Mm-hmm. So think Bernd and Hilla Becker, who documented a lot of the older version of those industries. That's sort of where I grew up, and with much more, much larger, much more monumental things also.
But whereas they're celebrating the beauty of those old, admittedly older forms, you seem to be speaking about sort of the end of that industrialization, the ruins of the industrialization, the impact as well that it has had on our land and on the environment.
I do, yes. So while my camera and the process, and anyway, analog photography, it can make the most frightening things look beautiful and intriguing. There are critical sort of voices speaking out of me also with some of these images. And anyway, the world in many cases is turned into Disney. So this beautiful view of Cleveland, I don't know what it looks like now, but this is from 1997, and they were just converting this area that we're looking at on the other shoreline, excuse me, into an entertainment world. And if we can go back to Pepsi for a moment, this, excuse me for a moment, is a beautiful, it's just used, it was a fascinating view, the Pepsi-Cola bottling factory situated on the East River of New York City, in Long Island City, following the shipping channel of the East River, they received the sugar cane. As you know, industry was laid out, and the factory had its, what I think, very beautiful corporate logo on the roof facing Manhattan. So my idea was to photograph this image looking through the theatrical grid onto the background of New York. The point I was trying to get to is that's all gone. It's condo land, and the logo was landmarked and sits now in some entertainment area on the shoreline, completely unrelated to the industry that it is part of. So I call that Disney World.
And this is your camera that you built on the top of the building?
That's right. Yeah. So I had found this beautiful situation of Pepsi and decided I really wanted to photograph it. And when I had successfully, after more than a year, talked my way to getting access to the factory and onto the roof, there was no room that I could use. But I had gone such a long way wanting to make the image that with a couple of friends, we built a camera with a zoom lens.
One of the interesting things too is, and you see it here, is your camera, I presume, is on this, built on this platform here. Because everything in your process is inverted. If another photographer making a negative and then a positive print had stood where you were standing there, they would have gotten the Pepsi-Cola sign backwards.
That's right.
But you, with everything being inverted, are able to capture it so that we can read it, plus the skyline behind it. This was really one of your, not first, but this was an image that I think captured public imagination tremendously. I remember seeing it at the time reproduced in a number of places, and there sort of was, I think, a lot of buzz around this work. It was, I think it really captured many people's imaginations at the time, and perhaps sparked or helped to spark some more of the revival of interest in earlier photographic processes and technique, like the camera obscura. We should probably move on. Here it is in an early exhibition. And then you've also made a number of photographs, not only of major architectural sites, but modes of transportation. You photographed a Zeppelin, but also a number of photographs taken at the Frankfurt airport. Can you tell us something about those, about either the process of making them, which must have been intense? I see that you did it before 9/11. I wonder if you would have been able to do it these days after 9/11.
So shortly, or where are we? 2001. It feels 7 years after I came, 8 years after I came to New York, but actually much sooner. In 97, I started working with the theme of voyage, travel, transportation. And that is actually a very important element in the context that we're talking about today, memory and time. It had essentially to do, for me personally, it's a very big step to move to a different continent. And I came entirely by myself, so one has to learn. I had to learn the language, I had to get to know the culture, and I had to start a new life in every way, find friends, and I was starting to work with a new medium. So basically uprooted myself completely from every kind of context that I had, and also was my means were very, very limited. I had no opportunities of going back to Europe much. And so the idea of working with this theme of voyage and transportation was really considering to wanting to capture some of that distance, you know, some of that, okay, here's Europe and here's America and what is in between. And so I turned to these vessels that serve transportation. The other aspect that I liked and that I like to link here with my photographic process is that, as we saw in the beautiful rendering that Sarah showed, the camera is an empty box of whatever size. In order to fulfill its role, it is a void, empty container. So in order for the plane to fulfill its role in life, it's empty. And then it takes on merchandise and it transfers it, if we're lucky, from New York to Washington or from Frankfurt to New York or wherever. And the camera does this transitional job between the incoming light and the captured image. So these two aspects inspired me to work with this theme, and I go to places where I'm invited to come. It's incredibly difficult still today, much less so today. I mean, in certain aspects, because my work is well known and I have important professionals speaking in my behalf. It's easier for me, of course, now to gain access to sites, but 9/11 changed the world. Nobody ever will photograph in an airport the way I did. Again, no matter who is speaking for you. So I always go still today to places where I'm welcomed. It's easier for me to transition myself to another continent than to talking myself into being welcome in a place where I'm not.
This is your camera up here. Is that correct?
That's my camera, and that is me directing the camera to the roof of the terminal in Frankfurt. Here is the camera. You see how it's related to the planes that come in and out of that gate. And if we could just go back, another image. Here, if you look carefully, you see the way I did, there's seven different planes overlapping in this gate during my exposure. And these were the things that I was trying to figure out for myself. How can I make it still a comprehensible image and yet give a trace of the change and the transition, the departure, and the arrival to capture the idea of movement and transfer.
So these are about the sort of layers of change and transition that's occurring in front of you. Very powerful.
That's a hangar in which the planes are serviced, if you're lucky. Mine wasn't today, so.
And I wonder if you can, perhaps we should move along as time is getting short, but speak about the importance of the buildings themselves. I mean, do you do an extensive amount of research ahead of time before you actually commit to recording a specific building? Are you interested in their architectural heritage? Is it the presence of the building? What attracts you to these sites that you have been photographing?
It's a great variety of things, I believe. In this case, it's to some degree a coincidence. It's the Battersea Power Station in London, and my gallery had invited me to do an exhibition in London, but they asked if I would consider to do a special project for the occasion. And I didn't know London and didn't know where to start thinking about it while I certainly try to avoid sort of the iconic image. So I wouldn't have gone to London photograph the Tower Bridge or Westminster. And flying into London, I looked out of the plane and there was the River Thames and I saw this massive power plant. And I landed and I went to the gallery and I said, I really want to see this thing. I was like, here and there and there and there. And they said, that's exactly what we wanted to show you. So that was great. And then it was inspiring to me because it's so monumental and completely deteriorated at the same time. So there's contradiction and ambiguity in this building. It's not a clean, perfect representation of power and ambition. There's always a crack, I think.
Many people have often referred to this building as having a cathedral-like quality as well, almost as if it's sort of a monument to the industrialization or to the merging, really, of religion and commerce in the 20th century. I think we have... And there's your camera again. And now here we are at Venice, which does seem somewhat out of keeping with some of your earlier photographs, which are often pictures of sites of industrialization, sites of tremendous power. What was it that attracted you to Venice? And you've returned repeatedly over the years, so it must have an enduring fascination for you.
Yeah, in Venice, my idea was I wanted to go and photograph the flooded city. And I don't really know where, but it started with this, you know, idea again of celebrating beauty and destruction at once, because the floods, as we all know, the Acqua Alta in Venice is consistently working on destroying and sinking the city. So I wanted to photograph the flooded San Marco, and taking the opportunity of the water in the piazza, where then the image would the city would reflect upon itself in the water, and sort of reflection and fact and reflection fact and mirror would sort of collapse into one another, which is, of course, also a photographic reference. So this first trip to Venice was carefully placed and planned around however much you can anticipate the high waters, moons, months, whatever. So here you see the Piazza San Marco half flooded. I've made more images with full floods, but this is particularly, if we can go back for a moment, is particularly telling. See, the dark foreground area is water, and the little vertical things sticking in there are the chimneys on top of that building. And you can't see them on top of the building because the sky is so dark, but you can see them in the reflection. And you can also see, if you stand in front of the image itself, how the water acts like a lens and magnifies the beautifully tiled floor underneath. But then, being in Venice, I was inspired to photograph many other things and inspired to work with the, you know, magnificent light, which is, of course, due to the water reflecting it up.
And then instead of photographing Venice when it had flooded, then you seem to have turned your attention to making a series of pictures along the Grand Canal, using the water there instead, which does reflect but also takes on a sort of very eerie quality, which I think further accentuates that sense of time being collapsed into these pictures, which are often exposures, I know from the National Gallery's one, over at least a couple of days, over many hours.
That's correct. Yes, this was, lucky me, the view from the studio that I had rented in Venice. So when I go places to make photographs, I go for many weeks, often months, and bring everything I have, so to speak, with me, assistance, a darkroom studio. So we establish all of that there, and I was able to rent this space at the Grand Canal, and it had this beautiful view to the other side of the river, and little boats were fastened to these poles, and floating in the water, they give a record of time.
And this is a series, now time is really getting late, so a series that you've done on the clock tower, perhaps in just moving along, we can get to this series where it's a view actually out of your studio window in New York, where you have photographed the construction of a building that was going up right across from you at several different points. I was really struck when I saw these photographs by the similarity that they had to numerous photographs that Alfred Stieglitz made 80 years earlier out of his windows, either at the Shelton Hotel where he lived with Georgia O'Keeffe or his gallery. Stieglitz too was always photographing the construction of the buildings. Yet unlike Stieglitz would stop photographing these views once the construction was over. And yet you've continued to photograph the buildings even once they're complete. And it's often seemed to me that these pictures become photography sort of acting as both a window on the world and a mirror on it as well, because it's reflecting, many of these pictures show the reflection back into your own studio as well as the other apartments that are there in your building. Was this a series that you just had to photograph once you saw the building going up? Was it a very obvious one to record?
Yeah, it was. And it was also, it felt like it was so upsetting that I felt like at least I photograph it, so to speak. It's now 20 years that I've rented the studio space, and I had this, what I thought was beautiful parking lot across the street, and there were people there and things happening. And of course, one day the big equipment came in, and that was the end of it. It was the end of seeing the sky, and was the end of having light in my studio, and was the end of seeing people on the other side of the street. It was the end of seagulls sitting on a lamppost. It was the end of sort of, you know, like, yeah, observing life in the city. Now there's this facade. It was quite dull.
The end of observing human life in the city.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's very much what Stieglitz, I think, was lamenting in his photographs as well. They were made in the depths of the Depression, 1931, when these huge skyscrapers were still being constructed in New York, despite the suffering of the people below, the lack of humanity of the modern city. And then we're ending here with some two works, at least, where you seem to be taking a new turn. This is a series of photographs of the moon that you made over a number of weeks, months, years. Can you speak a little bit about this and also the arrangement that, that you made of the pictures?
Yes, I can. So this fascinating life that I live can at times be quite lonely because I bounce around the globe, finding myself here and there and there and there and for months at a time. And I just remember one night I worked in a Benedict monastery in Germany. And it was in a remote location in the middle of a forest, very, very beautiful, but I looked out of my little, like, attic room where I lived, and there was the moon. And it was so beautiful, and there was a little lake, and the moonshine was reflecting on the lake. And I had started to just look at the moon, and I thought, okay, this is going to be a diary. Wherever I go, there's the moon. At least something accompanies me. And so I had this little point-and-shoot camera, digital, and I photographed the moon. And I found myself looking at that image quite a bit. And I thought, okay, I start a diary, just sort of to have a little fun. The projects I do to make the large black and white work are wonderful, but very, very ambitious, and not always fun. So I thought this was going to be something small and fun that accompanies me wherever I go, and I started to photograph the moon, eventually getting a little more ambitious and learning how to use digital equipment with the very long lens and photographing the moon in different places of the world. And whenever I took an image, I would have a digital machine print made, or I think it's called a laser print. They're color prints, 8x10, because I did want a hard copy reference of what I had done, not just a digital file. And when I thought, okay, this is interesting, I'd hang it on one of the walls in my studio. And after 2 years, the wall looked like this. And I had these ambitious ideas of making large black and white prints with a lot of detail of the moon, and I made some of those, but I felt that the idea of the diary and diversity and authorship was really more successful in these images.
And of course, the moon has been used forever as a means of measuring time, the passage of time. I think what's so fascinating about the order that you've put up here is that we want to read it in sort of a chronological way, seeing the moon go from a sliver and grow to the full moon and then back down again. And yet you've destroyed that chronological progression here.
Yeah, rightly so. And I tried very much to not do that, because there's so many astoundingly beautiful scientific charts that display that, and I felt like I had to go somewhere else. And I also, quite literally, I didn't photograph the moon every night to document its phases. That wasn't the project.
Mm-hmm. But another thing, which also seems like a new turn in your work, is this video that and sound installation that you took that lasted over 24 hours. Can you briefly talk about that while I flip through some of the slides? Unfortunately, we don't have a clip from the video, but we do have these stills, which I think give you a sense of it.
Yeah, in very much, I feel like it's very much in keeping of my photographic approach. I had this idea to make a video that records 24 hours of light and sound. And the sound really reflecting the light. If one is in nature, everybody knows this, that the natural world, the animals, the wind, will reflect the stages of the day and respond to the light levels. So I felt in this video where I used similar to Warhol, if you wish, not with Warhol on my mind, but the camera had a fixed frame but was running for 24 hours, and I had quite good sound recording material set up parallel to the camera. And so the camera view never changes, but the camera records this ever-changing aspect of light. You see, insects love to land on the lens. Over 24 hours, and the sound accompanying it. So one can basically experience either the light through the sound, or the sound through the light, or both together. And it's also remarkably interesting to see how the image changes by illumination. We feel we all know this clearly, but if you see it, you feel like it's a different place.
I think it also it calls to mind too, though, how one of the other sort of very destabilizing aspects of your black and white photographs is that there is no implied sound in them. Everything has been turned inside out so much that unlike, say, the Cartier-Bresson photograph, where we might be able to, in our mind, project the sounds that could be heard at that time, in your black and white photographs, there's no sense of sound. And that, too, I think, increases their uncanniness. And then here, this is just the final suite of photographs that we have of your photographing these radio towers in Germany. And here's your camera being lowered into position, and the radio tower itself, you watching it being lowered. And then your pictures.
That's right. A still fairly recent project of 2013. The idea of photographing again, if you wish, an instrument that reflects really high human ambition. These scientists that work with this radio telescope in Germany are studying black holes. And these materials that try to give reference about to the birth of the universe, really, really very, very ambitious things. And I was inspired. I wanted to photograph this amazing instrument that listens into outer space for tiny little snippets of information that actually has long disappeared. I wanted to record it with my black box, with this device of an empty space that just very, very patiently sits there and, so to speak, observes and listens in on the telescope that observes and listens into the universe. And I made a series of 18 photographs, and at the very end, I dared to make exposures that also show how the telescope tilts and turns into all the different directions of the compass to listen to its auditive information. So this is our last image.
Yeah, sorry, thanks. Well, it seems to be a great one to end on. I find this series so fascinating because your camera, your tool, which is so dependent on the interaction of light and chemicals, is capturing another tool, which is itself sort of recording a different kind of light, radio light, to capture information about worlds we can't see, we can't know, to reveal these hidden universes, just like you've revealed in your photographs. So both, I think, are really exceptional accomplishments. And thank you for coming today.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.